position. I actually am currently the co-founder and head of a consulting company in California in the clean tech space. I'm a lecturer at the University of Hawaii Manoa Business School. I'm on two boards and I'm running a fund with my wife in the area of real estate investments, a lot of opportunities throughout the U.S. for a year, be 30% lower, and the real estate prices will go down and be some great opportunities to invest. So we're going to set that fund set up internally. But in reality, what I'm looking for is another sort of turnaround to run a CEO, sort of mid-cap. It's a small high-tech company, or another couple more positions. So I'm interested in today's program because it's right up where I'm interested.
Good. Dave and I were talking before you all came in, and we must have known each other 15 years, because 15 years ago, David was with a company that I was also doing some speaking at, and that's how we met. The company was called Kennedy Publications. Are they still around?
They are.
Yeah. Okay.
Kennedy Information.
Okay. And David went off and then started a consulting practice and has been doing it for how many years now?
15.
So, and it's a very niche-y practice. It's called the Executive Search Information Services. And Executive Search Information Services provides independent information and advice to hiring organizations on the process of going inside. Going outside.
Right.
Or inside, right?
No, when companies go outside for future talent, that's our topic.
Okay, and then the clients include Fortune 500 companies?
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about how the biggest and the best do it.
Sounds good.
Let me give you that. Right. By the way, we're hooking David up, and 2 days from now, we'll have an MP3 of this program on our website, boardoptions.com, and then you can download that if you wish. All of our Seat at the Table programs are available on MP3 programs. The microphone will pick David up, but it won't pick you up.
So you can curse and scream.
So if you weren't here, it might be a little tricky to get the whole thing. Maybe I'll repeat questions. We'll see how we do. I'm going to be conscious of you, and if we get a recording out of this, fine. But we'll have a discussion. I actually prepared a lovely slideshow for you today. But I learned when I arrived that Larry would prefer that we just talk. And so imagine that you've just seen a terrific presentation. I'll tell you what we covered. We covered kind of like how we got here. That is to say, how we got here in terms of the whole function of executive recruiting at a large company, and kind of how I got here, and kind of what large companies have learned about managing executive search activity. And we can talk about metrics and performance and how search is managed and search firms and who's good and issues of ethics and professionalism or whatever may come to mind. I have a little take on, you know, how I think it ought to be done. You know, if you could do just these things, you know, these are the things. We can talk about trends. We can talk a little bit about board of director recruiting and how it's different from executive search, if you like. And in fact, I'll be happy to share my slides with you after we talk in a way that might amplify some of the things that we end up talking about anyway. So, how did we get here? I think maybe I'll start with just a quick history of executive search because it leads into, I think, the way I think and approach it today. And so pretty soon we're going to get to celebrate the 100th birthday of executive search. In 1918, Edwin Booz launched a management consulting firm in Chicago that you all know called that became Booz Allen Hamilton. And he was actually quoted at that time saying, often the best solution to a management problem is the right person. Well, in fact, several of Edwin Booz's very first management consulting engagements were searches for the Bank of Winnetka, Marshall Field, and Montgomery Ward. He was solving, in some cases, management problems with people. And it continues to make executive search consulting, I believe, at least in part of its current form today, a subset of management consulting. It really stems from the management consulting point of view. And Booz Allen built the greatest search firm that ever existed. And some of the folks who worked at Booz Allen left and started great search firms. And by the way, part of the reason, and Booz Allen eventually got out of the business, as did McKinsey and all the accounting firms, because when they got to a certain point in size, they had so many clients that the search practice was hampered. And the search practice was not a big part of the overall consulting revenues, and so Mr. Spencer Stewart left Booz Allen and started Spencer Stewart, and Gardner Heidrick left and joined John Struggles and started Heidrick and Struggles. A guy named Bob LeMailey left and started LeMailey Associates, which was a big firm for a while. Not anymore. We could talk about that. And a guy named Sid Boyden left and started a great search firm, still exists today, called Boyden. So many of these all just came right from the Booz Allen practice. Over at McKinsey, a guy named Ward Howell ran the search practice, and he left and started a great search firm that doesn't exist anymore called Ward Howell. But that's the genealogy of those big search firms. Another group came from the accounting side, or think of it as management advisory services, from the accounting firms. And so in 1970, Lester Korn and Dick Ferry left Peak Marwick and started Korn Ferry. And you can sort of trace Russell Reynolds to Price Waterhouse, where a guy named William H. Clark worked and launched a wonderful firm called William H. Clark, where Russell Reynolds first worked and then left and started Russell Reynolds. But we kind of credit that toward the accounting firm side. So there you've got most of today's largest firms springing from that background of management consulting. However, there's another wing of executive search, and it started traced to 1926. A guy named Thorndike DeLand in New York started recruiting buyers for Filene's and the May Company and other retail organizations. It really is another whole side of the retained search business that is really oriented toward the transaction. It's the specialist, moving one person from one company to another. Not a management consulting engagement, really strictly a search. And so that's kind of the rest of the world of search as we know it today. Lots of stuff happened in between, but now we're looking at an $11 billion business. My work started 23 years ago. I was a journalist for 18 years, the last 8 of which I was editor at Kennedy Information, as Larry mentioned. And Kennedy published, and I wrote Executive Recruiter News, and I also wrote Consultants News for the management consulting business. Because again, Jim Kennedy started covering management consulting, but saw search as a subset of that and broke it out as its own newsletter. So I wrote about search firms for 8 years and met all the players and kind of got a pretty good grip on at that time, several thousand retained search firms in North America, and about double that around the world. At the end of my time at Kennedy, I began to get calls from companies. What about this fee? Who should I use? And I realized that companies needed better information about executive search firms than a directory. And in fact, search is a business where anybody can be a search consultant. You don't get certified as in law or accounting. And it's somewhat mysterious. We're not really sure what headhunters do. And so buyers, I saw this appetite for an advocate or a buyer's guide to search services. Now, at the same time, now we're in the early 1990s, and it's re-engineering, right? McKinsey and the other management consulting firms are in your company, and they're telling you, hey, you know, you're spending $15, $20 million a year on retained search. Do you think you're getting good value from this? And companies didn't know. No one had ever written it down. And as it happened, when we looked at it, it turned out it wasn't really very efficient or effective. They weren't getting good value. And so they began to appoint someone typically reporting to the head of HR with the title of Director of Executive Search or Executive Recruiting or Executive Staffing sometimes. And my work has really kind of followed the rise of that role. It's really fun. April is here. She just got this new role at Boston Scientific. She's a perfect person to for us to think about, right? As I tell the story of how search management, that is the management of search activity, has become a function in today's Fortune 500 environment. So let's see. 1992, I get a call from IBM. John Akers is about to lose his job, although he doesn't know it yet. But the company is definitely in trouble. And part of the reason they're in trouble, they've never gone outside in any significant way. They've missed some business opportunities, like software. And so it's late in the game, but the directive comes, we need to do some searches, we need to bring in some outside people. This actually was kind of the forecast of IBM becoming a services company, because one of the first key searches that they did was for a guy named Bob Howe. They took out of Booz Allen, who started what's now the global services largest segment of IBM's business. But we didn't know that all that was going to happen, but they did know they needed to go outside. And 6 months later, I'm sitting at IBM, and the board is meeting down the hall, and the call comes to our office. Tell us the names of the CEOs of Heidrick & Struggles and Spencer Stewart. And so I gave them the names. It turned out they were asking the question not quite right. They were looking for Jerry Roach and Tom Neff, the CEO headhunters from those two firms. And in fact, IBM engaged both of those firms. They both pitched to do the search for a new CEO of IBM, because John Akers had been fired that day. And IBM decided to go outside for its next leader. And it was a crazy search because two firms were involved. IBM did that because of off-limits, something we could talk about if you want. But basically, IBM wanted access to all the potential candidates, and some of them would have been clients. And as it turned out, Lou Gerstner was at RJR Nabisco, and Tom Neff from Spencer Stewart had placed him there. So Tom could not recruit him to IBM. But therefore, Jerry Roach picked up the interaction with Lou Gerstner and closed the search. And really, this became, in my view, the most important search that ever happened. Because for a company of the stature of IBM to go not only outside for a CEO, but to go outside of its industry for a CEO was way out there. And for it to be successful, I think, gave a lot of companies the courage to think similarly. Now, it doesn't always work out. As a matter of fact, it never works out as well as management development does. But on the other hand, it doesn't have to be a terrible thing. Executive search can be a strategic opportunity, not just a necessary evil, I think. I guess I'll mention that everything we read about leadership is about management development. And Fred and everybody here would agree that that's the way to go. If you want to be a great company, develop great leaders. However, all great companies, especially when they reach a certain size, also have to go outside occasionally to fill gaps. If they're really doing a good job of succession planning, they know they have gaps, and they need to fill them from outside. But while Jack Welch always used to say, every time I use a search firm, it's to cover up a mistake we made, I like to think about it as, if you're head of executive recruiting and you're managing the process well, and if you've got a solid succession planning program, you're going to be able to anticipate needs to go outside, and you're going to be able to do that for strategic value, not just to make up for bad behavior in the past. So I like to think about search as a proactive opportunity. So I guess that kind of brings us to today, where we have, not quite. So after the IBM engagement, I actually wrote them a book about search firms and how to use them. We divided the world into 140 boxes and of industry and function and geographics, and I made search firm recommendations for them all around the world. And through that long engagement, realized that maybe other companies could benefit, would be interested. And so in 1995, I left Kennedy and started Executive Search Information Services to help companies just like this. I went around to a number word-of-mouth companies got in touch with me, and I would help them do that first discovery process. We'd walk into the company inevitably, once we figured out where the searches had been happening, we'd find that searches were taking 6 months on average, and 4 out of 10 searches were failing, almost universally. And if you calculate out the impact of that on the bottom line of a large company, it's magnificent. It's huge. It's millions. It could be hundreds of millions of dollars to fail at that rate. Yes?
I've heard that figure over and over again. Is there any research on that or any scientific?
I can show you my notes from company after company, and we've done surveys with the group. Now, I'll explain that. After doing work for individual companies, my client at IBM one day said, I'd like to meet my peers from other leading companies. This is kind of a lonely job. And so, because she was supposed to be the in-house expert on search and nobody else to talk to. So I said, I could introduce you to some of my other clients. And she said, that would be great. In fact, we should start a group and meet regularly and talk about this. So in 1996, we started the Executive Search Information Exchange. And we started to bring together companies to share information on this subject. And we have now been going for, we're in our 15th year. A couple of weeks ago, we had our 143rd meeting at the Harvard Club of New York. We meet 7 times a year in New York. And in 1998, we started a group on the West Coast. We meet 4 times a year out there. There are 47 Fortune 500-sized companies who participate across industries. And so we survey this group, and regularly they tell us what their completion rates are. And by the way, we define a completed search as filling the position with an outside candidate within 1 year. Now, some successful searches actually end up in the placement of an internal candidate. On the other hand, some unsuccessful searches end up with the placement of an internal candidate. So those are a little hard to evaluate. So completion, we never really, no one could really completely agree on the definition of a completion rate and find data to support that. But I'm, and actually if you ask anyone who's worked at any of the largest search firms, they will get around to telling you that somewhere in the 60% range is in fact their completion rate. They may say as high as 70, but if they said over 70, they'd be lying. Now searches fail for all kinds of reasons. And in my view, good search consultants deliver qualified candidates 80 or 90% of the time. Unfortunately, on the client side, I think 20 or 30% of the time, in other words, 2 or 3 of those 4 failures out of every 10 searches are really issues on the client side. The client never had consensus on why they were going outside or exactly what the need was, or there was a change, somebody changed their mind, or they were doing a search but it wasn't really a search, it was just an apparent search, or somebody had a hidden agenda, whatever. Searches fail, and some of those, change in business conditions, we're never going to be perfect. But we think that a company can get a lot closer than 60% by controlling its own behavior and by picking search firms who can demonstrate a strong record of performance. So I feel that those numbers are pretty solid. And in fact, we've been able to show that when search activity is managed, as it is by most of the companies in our group, those completion rates can get up to 80% or more, and cycle times can go down to 4 months, and maybe maybe even better. We're in the middle of a benchmark survey now that's showing average cycle time of 113 days, which is pretty darn good, actually, and completion rates of in 85% range, which is also pretty good. That's what a company ought to be shooting for. Maybe even go higher, but you got to take it that first step from when nobody's looking to something more effective than nothing. That might be enough for me to say as a warm-up to your questions, because we can go lots of places. Yes?
113 calendar days?
Yeah. Defined as from initiation of the search to acceptance of an offer. And a cool way to do it, if you're on the company side, is to break that in two and measure from initiation of the search to the day the successful candidate was presented. That piece of time is pretty much attributable to the search firm. The second half, from when the successful candidate was introduced to when they accepted an offer, is more or less in the control of the hiring organization. So if you're evaluating both of those things, you kind of can look at the cycle time in two pieces. Yes?
For the board or CEO at that level, what are some of the metrics or what are the sort of tools that you would say to help guide this process on both sides, both the internal and external? As a board member, what?
You mean?
Yes, I want to go VP of marketing.
For one, a single search?
Well, I think a search in general first, but then.
Well, basically the metrics fall into quality, cost, and speed. I mean, there's a few, diversity. I mean, there's some other things you can measure. And we talked about speed. As a matter of fact, if you're the CEO and you're launching a search today, part of the conversation and ultimately part of the engagement letter should say, okay, here's a 13-week process. Here's what's going to happen the first week, second week, third week, fourth week. And that's pretty much how long we expect it to take. It's plenty of time for the search process to work. If you try to shorten it to 2 weeks, you're probably not getting the best value out of the search process. And then cost, we could talk about fees and so forth. You'd have an objective there, and it's easy to measure. Quality, difficult to measure. You probably want to measure the quality of service that the search consultant provides, and you can do that at the end of the engagement by asking the hiring manager, what do you think? And actually, very interestingly, you could ask unsuccessful candidates, what did you think of the search process? And that can give you a read on the quality of the search process or the service that was provided. The real holy grail is the quality of the candidate. How do we decide that? Well, we don't really know for sometimes a year or two until we really see how that candidate has performed. By the time you get that metric, it's kind of late because you had to make a lot of decisions in the meantime. So, tough one. Company and companies are actually still grappling that. It's one of our current topics is quality of hire and how to do it. Yeah.
David, there's an organization, you know it, but I'm not going to mention it for the others. It's called the AESC, Association of Executive Search Consultants.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I think it could have been 10 years ago, I was reading a magazine in Fortune that was profiling the executive search industry. And there was a little quote saying the AESC had done a survey of their own members on quality. And that 40% of the search candidates brought in by retained search people have left the company 18 months later. And I thought, wow, that's a different measure than what you're talking about.
Something we call stick rate.
Yeah, and I thought, wow. And I've never been able to get the citation of the original research. I don't know if it's valid. I'm curious about what your experience is and the experience of your members.
I don't think people really know. I don't think they keep track of it well enough. And then unfortunately, there are so many other factors that come into play. there's a search firm called CT Partners that publishes its stick rater, or they did for a while, until 2009. And then nobody's stick rate looked any good. But this figure is very frequently cited, and I've heard a variety of sources. I've heard the U.S. Department of Labor. I've heard Right Management Consultants. I think that it's just been picked up, and it's very hard to substantiate. And it would never really be the same from year to year, depending on economic cycles. So what you can say is, for sure, executive search is risky, and people who come from the outside, in general, do not stay as long as those who you promote into the positions internally. I mean, it's risky, it's expensive, and it still doesn't work all the time, even when we get it right. Yes, Fred.
Have there been any changes in sort of follow-up, you know, the good search consultant's hired, good candidate arrives, sets the author and starts? Does the search consultant do any more either with the client or the candidate during that first 6 months?
Recent years, it's become kind of popular for search consultants to offer that service. And I would say that companies have been very lukewarm to the idea. That there's a strong tendency on the hiring organization side to feel like once we've made that hire, it's our baby. And we have our own coaching, whatever, onboarding program. We can take care of it. Companies, as you know, don't always do a great job on that. And possibly there is a role for the search consultant. But it's a kind of a funny situation because the search consultant, it's unclear where the motivations are. They've already been paid their fee. So maybe it's a partial business development exercise for them to kind of be in the company again. And meanwhile, the company's feeling a little bit awkward. They want to be coaching this person. So I would say the idea has not really blossomed.
I gave a speech to a group of managing partners on this issue about integrating onboarding and retained search. And, first is the issue of the dilution of profits for on the search side of things. The second is the best search people for the large search firms are transactionally oriented guys.
They're business developers.
They love to do deals. And once the deal is done, they're not interested. They want to go on to the next deal. That's where the money is. So then they're farming out to a consulting type to actually do the onboarding. They don't want to lose control of the client relationship, but they don't want to do it either.
Search firms and hiring organizations are actually not aligned very well. If you want to grow a great search firm, you want to pay your business developers big bucks. On the client side, if you want to use a great search consultant, you want somebody who executes the process really well. And so there can be a disconnect there. Yes?
David, two questions. Given what the world has been here in the last 2 years, certainly that profession has not been immune. Does any of your research give any indicators of how significant the impact has been other than the traditional unscanned stats on basically number of contingency firms gone, number of major retained search firms downsized to smithereens? And the second question is, what is your research showing in terms of where technology is going and its impact upon that profession?
Okay.
Because a lot of companies seem to be now, with the online capabilities, doing their own work.
Great. So, the long-term view for the health of the search industry is very positive because demographics are going to drive the need to recruit externally for the foreseeable future. And companies are gradually acting on what they have been saying for a long time, which is that leadership is really important. And so, they're going to pay more attention, they're going to work harder to find the right people. Search firms are going to be fine, but there's a lot changing that is going to make it maybe not quite as fine as it might have been. And technology has a big role in that. Probably the biggest trend that's going on right now in the management of search activity is the development of an in-house capability to recruit directly at the executive level. Most of the companies in our group, and the search industry is still somewhat in denial about this, but most of the companies in our group are launching or expanding a capability to recruit directly, forget the search firms, that there's, because technology, LinkedIn, you know, brings so much information available to an in-house team, and there are other advantages, that the in-house teams are showing some real impact on the market. And this was proven last year when search activity was down 40% last year. And if a company had an in-house capability, if they had two or three people on staff who were, had an executive search background and carrying out searches, if the company had literally no search activity, then those people probably got laid off. But if the company had some search activity, the in-house people were able to do it at a great cost savings. And the cost savings that can be contributed by an in-house search team to a Fortune 500 size company are significant. And that is a big trend. So if I'm in the search business, I'm a little worried about Heidrick & Struggles, Korn Ferry, especially because they're publicly held. And I'm kind of worried about the other largest firms because they live on volume. It's a big mouth to feed. And I think that the need is there, but there are problems with being a giant search firm. And but if I'm a smaller practitioner and I've got a nice fairy client base, and I think that the future looks pretty good, as long as I'm not depending on volume, because I'm going to find that more and more of my clients are doing more themselves, and the searches they're going to give out to search are going to be the ones that are really difficult, really unusual, or confidential. You can't do a confidential search directly. And you want to, the in-house team typically goes for the searches that are happening over and over again, where they get to know the population. And they begin to believe that they can create a better fit than the search consultant who doesn't really know the organization as well. Yeah.
At what point, back to the point of stick rate,
yeah.
At what point should the board start wondering or scratching their head, geez, we've got a really horrible stick rate here, what's going on?
Well,
I'm thinking about two companies in particular where six in, four out.
I think the board ought to be interested whether the stick rate is good, bad, or indifferent. They ought to, if it's good, they ought to be interested. If it's not good, they ought to be interested. Because, you know, we need to know what happens to leadership talent when it's either whether it's promoted or recruited. But many factors could come into play that would affect their thinking about it. So I couldn't give you a number and say, this is, you know, if it's here, then don't worry about it. I think there probably are always issues, and you should be just writing down who gets hired today, and you know, a year or 18 months from now, see what they're doing, and put that together in something that's probably more of a qualitative study than a measurable one.
You talked a little bit about price. What are you seeing in price compression? Because certainly, price compression is a problem, or in the search industry, or on a good side if you're on a company. The other part is having to do with price is are you seeing it affect any of the quality that search firms are producing, and or does that give advantages to the smaller firms that have less overhead in terms of that whole aspect? So the whole price side of it.
Okay. Well, let's see. There's nothing logical about search fees the way they're normally charged. It started out in the 50s, so it used to be 15%. And it kind of creeped up to 20 and 25 and 30 and 33. And it's been, you know, 33% of total first-year cash compensation has been sort of the standard among the largest firms for 20 years or so. But it's not, I mean, most companies don't don't pay that. We couldn't really call it the standard anymore. Although, actually, in our surveys, you know, many companies still do pay at that level. And if you're doing a one-off search with one of the biggest firms, they're going to hit you at 33%. And they're unless they're extremely hungry for your business for some other reason, they're unlikely to budge much. But if you're going to give them $1 million worth of business this year, then you can start talking, at least 30 or in the high 20s from the biggest firms. Now, the smaller search firms are always more flexible. And I would say 30% is a typical firm, typical fee for a small firm, sometimes less. By the way, I'm a big proponent of fixed fees. Because a percentage fee is really, it's so arbitrary. It doesn't really have anything to do with how difficult the search is. And many search consultants will tell you the more senior the search is, kind of the easier it is in a way, because boy, to hunt through thousands of candidates for that middle management job is a real pain. When there are only 12 candidates in the world who could do this, you're golden, as long as you have access to them. So fixed fees give you an opportunity to set a dollar figure and say and make an adjustment. You know, this search looks kind of difficult. We're going to have to look in both Europe and the U.S. or something, something that would make it an especially difficult search, might justify a slightly higher fixed fee. You still might use a percentage of compensation as a place to start, but you can make an adjustment. And then, once you've agreed on a dollar amount, you, the client, don't have to worry about, you don't have to worry about whether the search consultant has any self-interest in the compensation background of the candidates that they're introducing, because often it happens that, you've got somebody, two people qualified for the job, and one's making this and the other's making three times that. It happens. And you have to wonder, does the search consultant have an incentive? They're going to get a much bigger fee over here. But the client wants the best candidate. Shouldn't be worrying about that. So if you've agreed on a fixed fee at the beginning, you don't have to worry about it. Second point is, often compensation packages get very complicated when you're trying to close the candidate. And then all of a sudden the conversation may come along, on what number are we going to base that percentage fee? Are we going to include the relocation bonus or sign-on? And who wants to have that conversation when what you're really trying to do is close the candidate? So, again, if you use a fixed fee, you start it out in an easier place.
Just as a follow-up, have you seen average? Does it matter what the fixed is? Is it you're still staying on the percentage?
Yes. In our survey work, we ask, what's a typical percentage fee that you pay, whether it turns out to be a fixed fee or not? And more of those, it's true. Last year, we saw that soften. We saw, the biggest chunk is 30% is the most popular answer. There's still a few at the 33 and a few under 30, and it notched down a little bit last year. The demand is pretty good. Search activity has picked up pretty noticeably this year, and I don't know if we'll see search fees bounce right back. They're still hungry, but that's kind of about where it's been. Yeah.
So what I've heard you say in terms of my interpretation, I happen to agree with you. I don't think the differentiator is the fee, because there's not much of a difference between 30 and
30. That's right. We actually studied the impact of the difference between 33% and 31%. If you're spending, on average, as Fortune 500 companies do, about $9 million in search fees, it works out to a couple hundred thousand dollars.
So my question to you is, if you're in the space of a functional area that the expertise you're looking for is these number of firms focus in this area, what have you found to really be the decision-making differentiator for the client company when it's all said and done? What prevails?
In choosing a search consultant? Have you done this search recently? I hate to say it, because it's not really the best answer. But here's what happens. As companies have given oversight of search to this director of executive recruiting, this person has to make the case to line managers, recommendation of the search consultant. And so, unfortunately, there's a tendency to, first of all, rely on a name brand firm that you're, you know, it's like nobody ever got fired for using IBM or something. And so the large firms kind of benefit a little bit from that. I'm losing my point. The opportunity to introduce a small firm has got to be based on something better than, you know, I think this search consultant has a great process. Well, it's too fuzzy. It's got to be this search consultant knows everybody in this space and does this, you know, eats these searches for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That, unfortunately, is the main reason that search consultants get chosen in a shootout. They've come in, and oftentimes, this is, I'll tell you, my one of my least favorite techniques for, you're the head of HR, for a shootout is to ask the search firms to bring in, you know, three resumes. It's very common. It really shortchanges the process. It's extremely dangerous in terms of candidate confidentiality. And it cheapens the whole exercise, I think. But it happens. So that's kind of the extreme case.
Yeah. One just quick follow-up.
Yeah.
I appreciate your answers. I got mercy on April because having tried to do both sides of this, I have found that the differentiator, and you just said it in your own way with the big firms, is the ability to get a call back from an executive. And no disrespect to internal people, but it's very hard for them one-on-one to get the same ratio of callbacks from
I don't know about that. We haven't been able to prove that yet.
Yeah.
And some in-house search teams will tell you they get. It depends on the company you're working for. You know, I mean, if you're working for a hot company, you might get your calls back. If you're working for a known loser, then you probably want to be using more search firms.
I'll agree with that.
Well, even an unknown company.
Or even a company. I mean, look at the financial institutions over the past couple of years. Yeah. You know, there can be dangerous situations, and so sometimes, yeah, I think the brand name search firms have a bit of an advantage there.
Yeah, I had one question regarding your comment on the fuzziness aspect of this. I think most of us who've used different recruiting firms see somewhat different personalities independent of where their areas of specialization and market penetration capabilities are.
Yes.
Are you seeing any types of efforts to quantify what might be operational styles of the firms or inherent biases in their own approach, independent of what the candidates, or excuse me, the client's job specifications may be? Because I can clearly see today companies, search firms, that will basically want to send you big name company candidates when you may be looking for someone really much more scrappy, risk-oriented, entrepreneurial in their nature. And it's interesting to see some of these different companies, what they envision as what your ideal candidate might look like.
Boy, that's an interesting question. I guess I have to say no. I don't think that any of the largest search, let's take the largest search firms to start with, they have not really distinguished themselves in terms of being known to present, you know, different kinds of candidates. They really, I think they all listen as carefully as they can to the client, and they try to interpret the need and carry it out and bring you, you know, exactly what you think you're looking for.
And I certainly understand that motivation, and it's a wise one on their part.
Yeah.
But there seem to be inherent biases of playing it safe. Never send in the one who may have moved
there
too
could
much.
Be.
Maybe send in the bigger company candidate because bigger is always construed as better. There are certain tendencies that I've detected.
Well,
different firms.
That's
curious.
That could, I mean, I can imagine where that could develop. You know, for you and your experiences with two or three search firms, you know, you would start to see. And by the way, with the largest firms, it's really still about the individual consultant who's going to be carrying out your work. Because Korn Ferry, I mean, they're all big and they're hundreds of people and they're not all the same. They have different styles, and to an extent. They are, you know, the more senior consultants kind of get sort of personalized about how they, you know, they can tend to vary somewhat from how the firm normally does it. And it can, you know, it does take on a style. I suppose you could say, let's take Tom Neff and Jerry Roach, our two leading CEO headhunters. Tom Neff is your Mr. Logical. He's going to bring you the candidates with exactly the background that you're talking about. Jerry Roach is more the inspirational. Jerry Roach brought John Sculley from Pepsi to Apple. I mean, and, you know, kind of interestingly, he ended up closing the Lou Gerstner to IBM search. Jerry's the out-of-the-box guy. So those two make a pretty good illustration, but it's difficult to make, to sort of generalize that to their firms or the industry. But it's smart of you to be thinking about that and asking the search consultant about exactly those kinds of issues. The search consultant ought to be asking you as the client, what's your tolerance for someone who's not exactly what we're talking about? Fred?
I think the interesting issue is within the company, so who makes the call on which search firm we're using? Because you have the division president, the vice president of technology, and you have
yes.
the HR.
Yes.
I had a call the other day from a search consultant in California. He's looking for an HR person in the Boston area, the head of HR, for the technology division of this big Boston company. And he said, our problem is we don't know anyone in the Boston area. I told him, I said, well, then why the hell did they hire you? The issue is, the head of technology has a personal relationship with this guy in San Francisco, and he brought him to this company.
Yes.
He thinks he's great. So
corporate
didn't want to use him, but they were overruled.
We can take it from the old days. It was just the line manager. It was just, I played golf with this guy last week. He said So let's bring him in and have him do this search. By the way, nobody's looking. The search fails. That $100,000 gets buried in his expense budget, and hopefully nobody notices. This is going back to, you know, re-engineering and noticing the big spend and what do we do about it. Now we have oversight. And by the way, this is, you know, complicated in the lives of all search consultants everywhere, because now they have to develop business not only with the line managers, but also with these junior HR folks who, are half their age and they're throwing up obstacles like a 50-page request for proposal and so forth. Somewhere in the middle of that is a smart company with a director of executive recruiting who can contribute to the process and not be an obstacle. And more that person does have the decision-making power on who gets picked. At some point, senior management either says, we're going to let this thing happen ad hoc, or we're actually going to manage this process, and you've got to talk to the director of executive recruiting, even though I enjoyed meeting him on a golf course. So when that can happen, then that person has some real authority. And in our group, in this group of 47 companies, the head of executive recruiting is involved about 90% of the time, and actually has sole authority to make the decision about half the time or so. Good question.
I want to exercise my role as a timekeeper, like five minutes.
Wow, okay.
It's not a hard stop. If people want to continue, they're welcome, and if they want to leave, they're welcome to do that.
Go ahead.
The group that you refer to, that meets,
yeah.
Are they all really large companies? Or
yes.
I mean, how does this apply to your insights and information that you're gathering apply to smaller region? I mean, you know,
smaller companies.
So many hydrogen struggles out.
That's right. So if I'm, so let's say I'm a couple hundred million dollar company, and I'm only going to do a couple of searches this year. What should my approach be? Well, I guess I'd want my head of HR to be my company doesn't justify having a director of executive recruiting, so I'm going to have the head of HR be that expert. I would develop a relationship with a couple of boutique firms. I wouldn't even go near the big firms. I would look for a couple of smaller firms who were very tuned in to my company and our industry and maybe some of the functions. And this is a point, it's a wonderful balancing act because the search process, we believe, when done well, will yield a great candidate, whether the search consultant has done that search before or not. But on the other hand, we've got this other force. I've got a great slide here called the yin-yang of executive search. It's really, you can think of all the dynamics of executive recruiting, and they fall on this specialist-generalist transaction relationship, retain contingency. It's all the hard skills and the soft skills, the art and the science. It's a big trade-off the whole time. But if I'm looking for a search partner, I've only got a couple of searches, I'm going to lean toward the relationship. I want you to get to know my company. And if you've never done a CFO search before, but you know my company really well, I'm going to, give you an opportunity there. That's kind of how I would approach it. But you've got to have, there's a lot of trust involved there. It doesn't always work. Yeah.
As I'm digesting what you're saying, I think the Lou Gerstner hire, you said, was a good one. It was out of the box. It was risky, but it was artistic. And your answer to Tony's question was the differentiator is they do these for breakfast.
Lunch, I didn't say it was a good one. He asked
right, me. Right. Lunch, dinner. So how, as it, right. So how as either a consultant to help heads of executive recruiting, How can you help the organization not get another cookie cutter profile of the 3,000 employees they already have?
My advice would be to invest in the person in that position. The biggest problem in my work and therefore in this function for these companies is turnover in the role. What can make the function successful is for someone to establish credibility within the organization so that line managers trust them. And when they have that kind of trust and credibility, then they can make more courageous suggestions about what search consultant to use or how, in general, how to solve this problem. And when there's turnover and when there are less experienced people being put into that role, it makes it more difficult for them to carry that out. It really takes several years for someone to get the... It's about influence. It's not about control. This person never really controls the process. They're only trying to influence it. And to do that, they've got to be really smart and they've got to have good relationships. And it takes time. So if I wanted to build those partnerships, I would find a great director of executive recruiting and leave him in that role for several years. Good questions? Yep?
Can you talk a little bit about the search process and how it's changed? 20 years ago, I actually was put forward for a big job, and I got Russell Reynolds put a 22-page single space right up on me, starting with the way I dressed.
Yeah.
And it was for Rolodex, and it was relationships, and it was
very tough. It was different.
On the other hand, they could move relatively quickly because they had a group of 500 CEOs, they contact and match them and put them in.
Well,
seems now, I hear Rolodexes don't count anymore with the internet. It's LinkedIn, whatever. You don't need a Rolodex, you just need to be tuned on and understand people. And I'd have to say the searches I've done haven't seen 20-page write-ups. They tend to be much more concise and more focused on the job. And so how has that process changed? Is the process on... sort of internet broad-based and have the firms changed the way they do things, or do the boutique firms really sort of look for
I guess, the basic answer is I don't think the process has really changed that much, but some of the points in it have. I mean, the point of gathering information about candidates. I mean, in the old days, we literally didn't know who worked at that company over there. And so that was interesting. We had to call, and telephone research, original phone research, is really the foundation of the search process for retained search. in a way, it still is. But today, we've got a lot more information accessible. It's just that a cold call doesn't yield as much as a warm call. And so what the search firms, you know, pride themselves on as their differentiator is that, well, yes, we all know, you know, who works at Google, but I actually know these guys, and they'll take my call. Or they're great, you know, they're useful sources for me. So that's search firms, the playing field has been leveled. A small search firm has access to the same, pretty much same information as a large search firm does today. So then the differentiator becomes, do they have warm relationships there? These are great. We didn't talk about board of director recruiting. It's different.
It's 6 o'clock. If anybody would like to leave, feel free to leave. And if anybody would like to stay, talk about board recruiting. Let's do it.
Okay. Here we go. It takes longer. About 6 months at least. It's not, people are not applying for a job. So all the dynamics around presenting, doing referencing and inviting candidates to be considered have to be managed very delicately. You can't really check references on someone who's not looking for a job. When you do, you have to do it differently. You also are probably not going to, you don't present a slate of candidates on a board of director search because they have to be invited one at a time. It's a priority. Most of these things are fairly obvious, but I knew the board level work was a topic of yours. I mean, you all know, board searches are more important than ever. Search firms are being used more than ever because boards are looking for due diligence. They want to, I mean, Spencer Stewart did, it got to the point of being ridiculous. All the board searches that Spencer Stewart did for the bailout companies. The Wall Street Journal left out a quote that I had for him that I thought was pretty juicy, which was, if I was one of those bailout companies, no way would I be using Spencer Stewart, because they're doing search, there are only so many people who can be on the boards of GM and Citibank and Bank of America, and if Spencer Stewart is playing God with all the candidates, and I'm another company looking for the best candidates, I probably want my own search firm. I don't want Spencer Stewart to decide that this person would be better for GM than me. So it's kind of, but Spencer Stewart has a wicked grip on, they have 60% of the market for Fortune 500 board positions. And it's really, you're really looking for the option there. They're so dominant. But the other issues are, I'm sure, quite familiar to you. The positions are more important than ever. CEOs can't take as many board roles as they used to, and companies have to look to other levels of leadership to populate their boards. Diversity is huge. Almost every board search is a targeted search, looking for something that the board in its current makeup is missing, and it may not have to do only with skills or background. It may be race or gender or whatever. So that's a little awkward. But you know all these things. But it is, it's part of the greater world of executive search, and it requires the same kind of sourcing and network building. Although the research is continuous when you're doing board of directors stuff. If you're a search firm, like Larry has the talent bank, most search firms that do board of director search are doing ongoing research to turn up candidates who would be potential interesting board members for somebody. Those are a few things. Anybody have any horror stories about search? Want to share war stories? Do you like those?
They need to be home before
7. I made a comment earlier about, just being friends of somebody and they got the wrong person. I don't know anybody in Boston, was the search guy said.
Yeah.
I've actually been through searches where I was the candidate, but
for example, it was a publicly held retail organization, and all they did was retail, but they were searching for the general counsel because they were the search company for that particular company. It was a huge chain, and so they knew nothing. I was the first person they called. I happened to know somebody there. And this has happened more than once. I basically had to educate them on what a general counsel does and what a lawyer in-house will...
So that's an extreme case, but on the other hand, when you think about it, a lot of those qualifications are pretty well quantified. You've got a strong experience background to search on. So ultimately, maybe the issue in the search is how well does this general counsel fit in with the culture of the company? And the person who does general counsel searches all day long might not know the company well enough to understand the fit, whereas the search consultant who's done several other searches for this CEO might have a much better grasp on what kind of person is going to fit in the job. So even though they're not very well educated right now, that might turn some candidates off too. Well, they're learning fast.
Yeah. They didn't just do executive search. They did all the search from salespeople in the retail stores all the way up.
Well, now that gets a little tricky because you really have at the senior executive level, you're applying a different process than you are at the mid management level. And by the way, direct executive recruiting comes right in there. The meat and potatoes for an in-house search team is for in that 150 to 250 compensation range. Above 250, then the retained firms are into it. But sometimes it's hard to get good search services, and so you build that in-house capability to go after the middle ranks. Everybody having fun? Time to go? Why don't we break up? Yeah. Thank you very much. I'll hang around a few more minutes if anybody has a question.
And again, David's offered if you're interested in the PowerPoint slides of this talk, just give them your business cards. Okay. And next month, we'll have Fred Fulton talking about recruitment of board members from outside the United States to serve in U.S. boards. You'll be getting a notice about that. I'll also send you the MP3 of tonight's program as well.
Thank you very much.
Let me take that from you.